One of the most dangerous places you can fly may be your local pattern. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Bob also is a CFI based in the Buffalo, New York area, who operates Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated. We get together on Monday to talk about safety topics, sometimes from an angle you may not have heard before. Bob, thanks for taking some time out with our listeners today.
Hello, Paul. It's always my pleasure.
In the November edition of Over the Airwaves, you told a very funny story about being stationed in Vietnam. And tell us about that warning sign you saw.
Okay. I was stationed for a period of time back in 1968-69 and Long Binh. It was the U.S. Army headquarters in Vietnam outside of Saigon. And it was a 44-square-mile military, highly secured military facility that where U.S. Army headquarters were located. And occasionally we would venture off that compound and pass through virtually enemy territory. And there was always a big sign positioned just outside the gate of our facility that said, "Caution, you are entering the danger zone." And my first trip out, I thought they were talking about we were going into an unsecure area. And basically what they were talking about was Highway 1 coming out of Long Binh and heading into Saigon, very, very busily traveled highway that the military was referring to highway accidents, head-on collisions, and running into other people in vehicles. Mm-hmm. And so that seemed somewhat paradoxical in the middle of a combat zone. And I use that example to try to highlight a danger zone that we have in aviation, which surprisingly is not areas of thunderstorms or areas of high probability of icing or busy airspace out over big cities. I think the most dangerous place in the sky is that area that we commonly refer to as the airport traffic pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, for example, that more accidents, mid-air collisions, occur in and around the traffic pattern than in any other airspace in the world. So that statement alone supports my position that this, in fact, is the most dangerous sky aloft.
You know, and that's somewhat counterintuitive, especially for beginning pilots, because especially on a cross-country flight, you know, you go through whatever stress is involved in navigating from point A to point B, and when you find yourself with the airport in sight and you're, you know, coming down to whatever, 1,500 feet, making that 45 on the downwind, whatever, I think my tendency, at least on the first few cross-country flights I made, was that is the point where I started to relax a little bit, and that's maybe the last thing you should be doing.
Exactly. And it's not that the traffic pattern inherently is dangerous. It's the fact that when people make mistakes aloft, and when they make them in areas of congested airspace, such as a traffic pattern, the consequences are far more dire than if they happen out on an open cross-country trip. It's simply because others in the pattern may not be up to their game in maneuvering through the pattern. And I use a few examples of problem people in the traffic pattern. One person I refer to is the person who's talking but nobody's listening. And this is an individual who's chatting away, giving position reports on the wrong frequency. He hasn't checked a recent sectional. There may have been a frequency change in the past 6 months or a year, and they're still chatting away on the wrong frequency, not hearing anybody replying, so they're boldly moving, thinking others are clear of their path, and that's not the case. We had another one that up here in Canada, or near Canadian airspace, we have a lot of crossover between Canadian non-towered airports in U.S., and I kid my Canadian friends, they are very, very chatty folks on the radio, and I call these folks Chatty Cathy, and we'll hear very frequently up here, and I offer my apologies to my Canadian friends. I don't mean to insult them, but if you listen carefully to Canadian transmissions, it goes something like this: "Hey, this is Charlie November Foxtrot Bravo, white and brown Cessna 172SP, fixed gear aircraft, just 3 miles south of the 401 at 4,500 feet. We'll be passing over the dead side of the runway 21, then turning on the crosswind to join the downwind," and so on and so on and so on and so on. And they take up, you know, about 90 seconds of very congested radio space to announce their intentions, meanwhile blocking everybody else from not only at their airport, but other airports who happen to share the same frequency.
Well, you know, actually, that's not limited to Canada, Bob, because when I was training in Oregon, in the Willamette Valley of Oregon at some of the little airports there, I found that those people, for some reason, always seemed to turn up on a Saturday when there were nine people in the pattern.
Yeah, and they're the nicest people in the world. And when I meet them on the ground at a breakfast, they're just as chatty as can be, just as if they were on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, conciseness on the radio is something that we all need to work on. You know, give the position report. Then we have another one I call the Mr. Magoo. This is the blind as a bat, bumbling pilot who, you know, moves from the taxiway onto the active runway without looking left or right. And, the guy who's on short final is forced to, you know, sidestep and go around because this individual never, really looked outside the window. We have this problem in our own training fleet, particularly those, who are enamored by the G1000 glass cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a common, concern that we have, that we're all focused on the gauges and the colors in the cockpit without looking out the window.
Well,
I've got another one. I really do want to mention this one because I think this is one of the most problematic things that go on in the traffic pattern, and I call this the local tour guide pilot who says something like this, Bixby traffic, I'm over the Blue Water Tower inbound for the airport, you know, and I'm traveling along with a student from out of town, and he says, well, which blue tower do you think this other guy's referring to? And I say, only he and other locals know where that is.
Right.
And that's this idea of giving position reports based upon unfamiliar sightings on the ground.
You know, I have to hearken back just for a moment to Mr. Magoo, because I one of the airports I trained at had established traffic patterns, published traffic patterns that used the main runway for fixed-wing traffic, one of the taxiways for helicopter training, and the other taxiway for gyroplane training.
Oh,
and you'd have these guys who would come and they'd open up their hangar on a Saturday morning and stretch their arms and yawn, and they'd go in and bring their plane out and get it started. And then just, you know, they'd wait till the run-up area to turn the radio on.
Oh.
And I can't, there were many times when you'd hear, you know, somebody call that they were on final for the East taxiway. And here comes, you know, this fly baby rolling out with a scarf trailing in the wind. And that was very alarming. Now, well, you also mentioned, Bob, you mentioned the amateur air traffic controller, and we've all heard these.
This is the most tragic of them all. I was going to a fly-in breakfast at a neighboring airport last spring, and the airspace was packed. It was full. The pattern was full. And I heard an elderly gentleman get on the radio and start giving landing clearances, you know, blue and white Cessna, your number one, and Yellow Piper, your number two, so on and so forth. And he sounded considerably older than the mandatory retirement age of most air traffic controllers. So I listened carefully, got my landing clearance, so to speak, came down, and I tracked this individual down. Here was a gentleman. He was going about 350 pounds. Not that that was an issue, but he's sitting in a wheelchair with oxygen in his through a nasal cannula, which, dear soul, he had to take probably to continue breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And in his right hand was the microphone. And I'm not sure he could see the traffic pattern. Yet he was doing his dead level best to get everybody in on the, without running into each other. You know, I've got a strong and a high respect for air traffic controllers. They're professionals in every way, shape, or form, and they are trained to do this sort of thing. And when we have a well-intentioned, experienced aviator standing on the ground with a handheld mic attempting to give landing clearances to a full pattern, I think that's an invitation for disaster. First of all, I wouldn't want the liability if I was that individual.
You know, that's what I was going to say, Bob. If something went wrong, would you want to be the guy who had assumed that responsibility?
No. I mean, I don't understand it. And then when somebody comes up and hands him a plate of eggs and pancakes, of course, he puts the microphone down and jaws those down for a little while. And meanwhile, everybody he's given a clearance to, they're wondering, you know, who's next. I mean, there's just no rhyme or reason other than some, and it's always a well-intentioned individual who's looking out there trying to be helpful,
mm-hmm.
not realizing that he could, in fact, be putting people in harm's way. Because as soon as you're given a landing clearance in the real world, one assumes that you're next to go in.
Right.
And if he gives the wrong guy that clearance and that wrong guy is immediately behind me in trail and cuts in front of me, you know, those are accidents waiting to happen.
Well, one final example, we've all seen it and we've all dealt with it coming into small airports, and that's the guy who's flying the airliner pattern with his J3.
Yeah, I call him Captain Dean Martin in his Boeing 707, if you remember one of those classic airport movies.
Right.
These guys that, and oftentimes, these are the pilots who were trained at the big Class C airports, where they are a tower controlled airport, where, you know, they're given instructions as to when to turn base, and sometimes it's 3 miles from the end of the runway. We can't do that in these small non-towered fields. We have to make these turns on base, you know, just no more than a quarter to a half a mile from the end of the runway. Once those patterns get out so big, we can't see the other individual, and then we have people cutting in front of them, and then the poor guy in the long downwind, he's wondering where this guy in front of him comes from, and again, accidents waiting to happen. If we could all just stay in real nice, close and tight, I use as a guidance to my students, I said, you know, if the engine failed right here in the traffic pattern, could you reach the runway? And if you think you can't, then perhaps we're too far out, that pattern has just gotten too big.
I would have to add one more caution to flying around little untowered airport patterns, and that is that I've made a lot of flights at night because A, I enjoy it, B, I feel it challenging, and there was often a situation where I would be at a small airport and somebody was using that airport to practice their instrument approaches at night. And they weren't on the CTAF frequency and they weren't really paying attention, and they just assumed that nobody would be there. And we have to make sure we don't do that either.
Paul, I'm sure glad you made that point. Mixing practice IFR approaches to non-towered fields when VFR conditions exist is also a very hazardous endeavor, because just as you pointed out, the instrument pilot is under a hood. His safety pilot might be looking at the instrument pilot, and nobody's looking out the window. And then the hapless pilot on the VFR downwind base, the final, he may have no clue as to what's going on. And oftentimes that instrument approach is a downwind approach. They're just practicing a 2-8 approach, and the winds are howling out of the east, which means the pattern is going the other way. You could actually be landing into departing traffic if you're that person on the practice instrument approach.
You know, I'm sure we have listeners, Bob, who are going, oh, I have one. If anybody does have one, email it to me and we might discuss it another time. My email address is paulp, that's P-A-U-L-P, at aero-news.net. Bob, when we come back, we're getting into that time of year when it's possible to do an instrument rating without ever using the hood, especially in your part of the country. I want to talk a little bit about that. My guest is Bob Miller of Bob Miller Flight Training and also of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot. I'm Paul Plack. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Do you feel stimulated? Hey, that's why Congress passed the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008, so loyal Americans like yourself would feel stimulated to help rev up the economy by spending money on important stuff like new Garmin avionics. We're talking potential tax incentives, bonus depreciation up to 50% in first-year cost allowances for qualified business use equipment purchases. See your tax advisor for guidance and your Garmin dealer for one whale of a stimulus package. It's almost like your patriotic duty, huh? Garmin, follow the leader.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt, talking with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, also of Bob Miller Flight Training, which is based at the Lancaster Buffalo Airport in Western New York. And that is a place, and this is a time of year, Bob, when if you get somebody who wants to do an instrument rating, you don't maybe ever need foggles.
No, we don't use foggles unless it's July 4th when we have sunny weather. Most of the time beyond that, we have clouds that we can easily work within to give real training in IFR conditions. And this is the time and this is the place to do it, believe me.
Well, tell us about the experience you had recently with a student who decided that he wanted to do an IFR rating, and you said he got it done in 9 days in your area.
Yeah, I have to publicly acknowledge and give great credit to a gentleman named Floyd Packard from Middle Eastern Washington State. Floyd is one of these pilots that you just admire. You know he's going to be a safe pilot for the rest of his life. Floyd is building an RV-7, and it's going to be IFR capable. And he called from across the country, and he says, Bob, he says, I'd like to do some IFR training, but my local CFI is reluctant to get into the clouds. He wants me to do it under simulated conditions, but I understand you do it out there in the real world. Could I possibly come visit with you and spend 10 days in hopes of securing my instrument certificate, my instrument rating? And, I paused. I stalled a little bit, and I called him back after some consideration. I said, well, come on out. We'll certainly do our best. We'll work you hard for 10 days, and we'll see where it takes us. And the reason I was hesitant is I have been openly critical of the accelerated instrument training program, believing that anything that's learned fast is forgotten fast.
Mm-hmm.
But my conversation with Floyd, I said, under one condition, will this program that you're asking me to run by you or with you, is if you make a commitment to yourself that as soon as you obtain your rating 9 or 10 days later, you will put it immediately to work. You won't just let it sit on the shelf, because if you do, whatever you learn will be quickly forgotten. So he says, nope, that's my intention. As soon as I get back, I'm going to, be in the clouds at this end, and I'm going to keep it up. So anyway, he came over to Buffalo. We started him on October 1st from scratch on the instrument. And on October 9th, he took his instrument check ride with a very challenging, hardcore instrument, designated pilot examiner. And mm-hmm. he came through this thing with flying colors. And I think, in retrospect, I said to myself, is he going to be a safe pilot? Well, on day one, when he was here, we were in change of season weather, which put us up at about 6,000 feet, sub-freezing clouds, a combination of freezing rain, ice. We had adequate back doors below and above, but he had an opportunity to see firsthand what hazardous wintertime conditions were like. And at the same time, learn the IFR procedures. And we proceeded to do that for the next 9 days, 5 hours a day. It took two instructors on our end just to keep pace with this individual because of the demands. But it worked. And at the end of the deal, he had seen every form of IFR weather imaginable. As I said, from icing to turbulence, to very poor visibility to heavy rain. And managed to acquire the necessary skills to make him a very, very good instrument pilot.
Well, and when he gets back to where he's going, if he's in the middle or eastern part of Washington State, he won't have to deal with the amount of cloud cover that the Seattle area gets. But there is plenty of very challenging weather that he, especially over the winter, will have a chance to fly in.
Well, and just one last point on this, my work with instrument pilots, doing BFRs and IPCs, instrument proficiency checks, I do them in the real conditions. And, oftentimes I see an instrument rated or so-called instrument rated pilot. I'll take them up in the clouds and we'll start doing steep turns, and I see this cold sweat running down their face. And I'm saying, what is the problem here? And he says, well, in most cases, they say, I've never done a steep turn in the clouds, or I've never hardly been in the clouds. And I'm saying to myself, what is impacting adversely his performance is not necessarily the lack of skills. It's his mental attitude. He's frightened.
Mm-hmm.
And once we're frightened, our brain, our thinking ability becomes severely compromised. I think that most IFR accidents occur because somebody panics rather than fails to, follow a procedure properly. And unless we do our training in the clouds where we can overcome that sense of panic, where we can develop the confidence, I think these panic-related accidents will stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, a lot of people who have died in IMC would have been okay if they just had the airplane trimmed and maybe just flew a little bit with the rudder until they got through what they were going through. It's You know, it takes a pilot to initiate that spiral in most cases.
Oh, you know, you're absolutely right. I've tried to teach people that if you fly just with rudders, trim the airplane, fly with a rudder, guess what? The airplane cannot stall. I defy any of our listeners to stall a trimmed airplane using rudder only.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't stall it, we can't spin it. You know, the classic JFK accident where all he had to do was just keep his wings level, and if he couldn't do that, have the sense of presence of mind to push the autopilot button. And in that Saratoga, the airplane would have likely righted itself, and he could have flown himself right out of those conditions. But why we do not do that, I think, is more related to a state of mind or a lack of confidence or a panicky situation where, you know, it's a fight or flight kind of human reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And we can easily overcome that if we would only train our pilots in the clouds. Now, one last statement. I've heard my critics say, well, Bob, you know, if you train here in Phoenix or you train here in Albuquerque or Tucson, we don't have IFR conditions. Therefore, how can we be expected to do that? Well, I would just point to Floyd Packard. He flew 3,500 miles in an airliner to Buffalo, where he could, or to any of the northeastern cities, he could have done the same thing, and any flight school could have provided this kind of training. Go to where the training exists. You know, if all you have is sunshine and you want to learn cloud flying, go to where the clouds are. I live in the flatlands of New York. If I want to learn mountain flying, shoot, I'll go to where the mountains are. I mean, it seems to me to make common sense, but oftentimes, common sense doesn't rule in this business.
Bob, as always, we appreciate your thoughts on this Monday. We'll catch you again next week.
Thanks, Paul.
My guest has been Bob Miller. You can find out more about Bob at overtheairwaves.com. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.